The next reading is again from John chapter 1, and we'll continue reading where Claudius left off in chapter 1, and for good measure I'll begin from verse 14. John chapter 1 verse 14 says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, 'This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." This Christmas, as at every Christmas, we have to gaze upon this child in the manger and the nativity scenes everywhere, and we have to get down beneath that and wrestle with this whole idea about the incarnation, because that's what's going on underneath the cute little pictures. The incarnation, this idea that God became human. It is epic. It is too much for us to even process properly, but we have to come and wrestle with it, because this is what the Bible declares to us. God became human. And particularly, we're at a good place to wrestle with it here in John's Gospel, where we've ended up. Particularly this morning, I think that last verse is probably going to do us. Just that one verse there, I think there's enough in there for us to chew on for the rest of our lives. And I think we're meant to chew on it for the rest of our lives, to be quite honest. So there should be plenty for us today to feed upon. Let me read it again. "No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." As I say, there is too much for today. But if we just break it, I think, into three parts and try to process it, I think we'd be doing well. It starts out pretty easy, doesn't it? No one has ever seen God. Although I must admit, I thought, you know, didn't Adam walk in the Garden of Eden in the cool of the evening with God? Wouldn't he have had a chance to see God? I looked that up, though, and Genesis 3:18 actually says that Adam and Eve heard the sound of God walking in the garden in the cool of the evening. The Lord appeared to Abraham, I know that. Genesis 17:1, the Lord appeared to Abraham in Genesis 18:1. Get a little bit more detail about how this was happening. Abraham was visited by the Lord via three men who came and visited to him. So there's some kind of step of distance here going on, isn't there? Jacob, he wrestled with God, didn't he? He wrestled with God. He said, "I have seen God face to face." He called the place where he wrestled like that the face of God, Peniel, because he said, "I have seen God face to face." But actually, he wrestled with a man all night long. He wrestled with a man, it says. Moses is called the one who God knew face to face. The one who God knew face to face in Deuteronomy 34. But keep reading. Deuteronomy 4 clarifies for us that Moses, in all of those dealings with God, Moses had heard the voice but not seen the form. John says, no one has ever seen God here in our verse. And we wonder, well, why not? Why not? Why is this? A very simple reason, first of all, is that God is spirit. No one has ever seen God. God is spirit. If you'd like to keep reading John's Gospel over the summer, and I really encourage you to do that if you want to get into this incarnation idea, John chapter 4, he speaks to the Samaritan woman at the well, and he teaches her, God is spirit. Those who worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. God is spirit. There's one simple practical reason, I guess, behind what John says here in our little verse 18. But at a more deeper level, no one can see God because of his holiness. His holiness. When Moses was dealing with God through those first books of the Bible, he asked if he could see God and look upon his face. And God said, no, you can't. He said, I will pass by you in Exodus 33, if you'd like to look it up. I will pass by you and you will experience my glory as I pass by, but I'm going to shove you in the cleft of that rock so that you cannot look upon my face, because if you look upon my face, you will not live. God is holy, holy, holy. And the flip side of that, we cannot look upon a holy God because of our sin. The prophets tell us that God's eyes are too pure to look upon evil, and here we are riddled with evil. So there's a deeper reason behind the first part of this verse. I always remember this atheist interview, a very popular atheist giving an interview. And he just explained to the interviewer, look, if somebody could just bring me a sample of God, just like a little jar of godness that I could look at and open up and I could just check and not, then I would believe in God. But you are wrong, Mr. Atheist, at two levels. First of all, because God is spirit, so no one can do that. But even more profoundly, you are wrong to think a sample of the holy God should be brought before you. You've got something fundamentally wrong in your logic, my friend. You are corrupted by sin just like the rest of us, and we cannot approach God in that state. Even in visions, Isaiah, it seems to me, in Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah is having some kind of dream sequence, some kind of vision where he beholds God's glory. He looks upon him. But even in the vision state, he says, woe is me, woe is me. For I'm lost, I'm a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. Woe is me, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. It's too much even in a vision. Which is the same pattern throughout the scriptures when people encounter visions of God or messengers of God, they end up face down on the ground in fear. Why? Because of our sin and because of God's holiness. We are corrupted by sin, and to us, God stands and dwells in unapproachable light, Paul teaches us in 1 Timothy. And yet now, as we celebrate at Christmas, Jesus has brought us into God's presence. This incarnation, we've got to get into it. He's done it by, at the practical level, embodying God in some kind of form that we can see and comprehend and experience. On the other hand, he's done it so much deeper as we dig down. He's done it by dealing with our sin so that we may experience God. We may stand in the presence of God, and we will forever because of this incarnation. There is no other way for this to happen but what the Gospels proclaim to us about this God who became human so that he could lay down that human form for our sin. There is no other way. If you do keep reading John, you get to chapter 14, Jesus says this, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on you do know him and have seen him. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it's enough for us. Jesus said to him, have I been with you so long, and still you do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. In chapter 12, Jesus cries out to the people in the streets and says, whoever believes in me believes not in me, but in the one who sent me. Whoever sees me sees him who sent me. No one has ever seen God, but the only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Then we've got to realize with that second part of the verse there, and the third part of that verse there, if Jesus has done this, if Jesus was able to make God known to us, then Jesus must know God. Because no one knows God except God. So if Jesus can make God known to us, then he must know God. He must be God if he can reveal God to us. So John can rightly say there in verse 18 that the only God who is at the Father's side has done this. He must be God to be at the Father's side. And everything else, by the way, that we read earlier this morning. This Bible proclaims to us God Most High. God Most High. But how could that mean anything if there is someone else other than God with him at his side? It just doesn't make sense to speak like that. If someone or something from God's creation is sitting there alongside with God, then how can God be higher than everything, higher than his creation? But of course, John explained it to us in verse 1 that Claudius read before, and in verse 2, and in verse 3, and again, and now again here in verse 18, Jesus was with God in the beginning, before creation. He's not part of creation. He was there before creation. Always has been, always will be, beside the Father. Jesus is God in his very nature. At the same time, he is at the Father's side. Welcome to the beautiful mystery of the Trinity. There are three distinct persons, Father, Son, and Spirit, but one divine substance. Now, some of your translations this morning that you're looking at in front of you might say Son there in the middle part of the verse there, the only Son who is at the Father's side. And to be fair, there are some old Greek manuscripts that we have that do say that. But the overwhelming likelihood, the overwhelming majority, is that it's exactly as I just read there and is sitting on that screen there, the only God who is at the Father's side. But there's no difference, I've got to tell you. There is no difference whatsoever because of what we've learnt in John, the first 18 verses there. Either way you want to take it, the meaning is clear. Nobody can be at the Father's side. Only God can be worthy of that position. It's not just the first few verses in John's Gospel. It's actually woven all the way through those first 18 verses of John's Gospel. 10 times, if you search it carefully, 10 times John establishes very clearly the deity of Christ. And you're not going to get away from it if you want to move on from these 18 verses. If you do want to read the rest of John's Gospel, you are never going to get away from this point. Because it keeps coming up. Every page, every paragraph almost, this is put front and center before us to wrestle with. Jesus keeps bringing it up. He keeps saying, I am. The divine name of God, Jesus applies it to himself. He makes himself equivalent with God. He doesn't say things only God has the right and ability to do and say. He says things like, I and the Father are one. He says, I am in the Father and the Father is in me. How do you say these things unless you are God? Jesus won't let this go if you want to read John's Gospel. And of course, he does the works that only God can do, miracles that only God can do. He says to people, then if you can't believe my words, believe the signs. Who else could do these things but God? He teaches people to pray and ask for everything from now on that they ask for in his name. How do you do that? How do you teach people that unless you are God? And of course, people worship him. The man born blind in chapter 9, if you get that far, worships him. Thomas, for all his doubts, Thomas gets the punchline to John's Gospel as he declares, my Lord and my God. There's no doubt in John's Gospel about this matter. Absolutely no doubt. It is full of witness. John the Baptist gets woven in here in the first few chapters as the prophet witnessing to Jesus. Nathanael witnesses to him. Thomas witnesses to him. The miracles witness to him. John himself, as he finishes this gospel, says, this is why I wrote my gospel. He won't let this question go because Jesus won't let this question go. We have to wrestle with the incarnation. What's written there in verse 18 is true. And I know that most of you here, if not all of you here, would know these things to be true. But we must say them and we must proclaim them. And I must ask you to beware of certain people. At this time of year, there are certain people who would love to come and knock at your door and try to rattle you. Try to persuade you that Jesus is not God, actually. That he's somehow less than God. That he is a God. So I must speak and I must warn you. They understand the first verse of John's Gospel there to say that Jesus is a God. And they're pretty good at their persuasive arguments. They will press in on you very hard with fine-sounding arguments. All this logic you never heard of about Greek grammar and the Greek article. But beware of them. Their argument is heavily flawed. Their argument is heavily flawed. They do not understand what they're saying about the Greek. They do not understand John's Gospel, because, as I say, you cannot escape this issue by changing one thing in that first verse. And FYI, you might like to know that in their own translation, their fine-sounding Greek logic about the name of God, it actually happens quite a lot. It happens 282 times in the New Testament, that kind of Greek grammar. And in their own translation, they only follow their logic there in verse 1, 6% of the time. Because they're just wrong about the Greek grammar. The rest of the Bible wouldn't make any sense if you applied their rule to the rest of it. It would be nonsense. So let them go their own way this Christmas season. They have fine-sounding arguments when it suits them and only when it suits them. But their arguments are wrong. So let them go their way and put all your energy into the truth instead that John is so clearly laying down in front of us, and indeed the rest of the Gospels. Everything else we've read this morning, the answer is incontrovertible. There is no question about this according to these scriptures that we've read this very morning. Jesus Christ was most certainly a human being. He was most certainly a human being, born of a woman, Mary, born the old-fashioned way, like every one of us has been. He was human, but he was almost certainly, also certainly in his very nature, God. You just can't get away from it. He's Emmanuel, we read. Emmanuel, God with us. Im is the Hebrew preposition with. The manu bit attaches the first person plural pronoun to that. He's with us. Who's with us? El. El is with us. God is with us. Elohim is with us. The one who John clarifies here in verse 1 and verse 2 and verse 3 as the guy, you know, who created the heavens and the earth back in Genesis chapter 1 verse 1. Elohim is with us. There's no getting around it. God has made himself known. If this is what Jesus has done in the incarnation, made God known to us, then we've got some good stuff to work with. I think in the last part of this verse is where my mind's really invested. If he has made God known to us, then what has he made known to us about God? What is God like? This is probably the biggest question our human minds, our puny little human minds, could ever even wrestle with and wonder about. What is God like? Well, if Jesus has made God known to us, then what did he teach us about God? What do we learn that God is like from Jesus? Quite a lot, as I say, if you want to keep reading this gospel over summer. I just want to point a few things out to you about our God that Jesus has made known. First of all, God is patient and gentle. And God is patient and gentle. I think we can say that with supreme confidence because Jesus has made that known to us. How patient was Jesus with people? How patient was he even with his own disciples, who at times were stubborn, self-seeking, unbelieving, and entirely unfaithful But how patient was Jesus with these people and with all people? How gentle was Jesus? How gentle was Jesus as he lifted people up? Broken people, like the woman caught in the act of adultery, if you get up to chapter 8. The woman caught in the act of adultery and dragged before the whole town in a moment of shame that I'm sure none of us could even process what that would be like. But how gentle was Jesus with that woman? Lifted her up and restored her. So I can tell you with confidence that our God is patient and gentle, because Jesus has made that known to us. God is forgiving and loving. How often Jesus thought about forgiveness, even declared God's forgiveness on people, right there on the spot, just declared God's forgiveness on sinners. How unbelievably, though, he modeled forgiveness. He modeled forgiveness at the cross, pleading for the forgiveness of those who crucified him. At the cross, he showed us the depth of God's love. That's what this is all about. God's love for us. This idea that God the Father would send God the Son. That God the Son would lay down his life for our sin against God. That is just mind-popping. Forget whatever the world's talking about with love. That is love right there. That God gave us his Son. God is forgiving. And God is loving. Jesus has well and truly made that known to us. So there's a few things. And I hope they serve you well as you process them over Christmas. I can't tell you how much I needed God's patience this week. Just this week. How much I needed reminding that my God is gentle. That he forgives. That he loves. I don't know what it would have done if God wasn't patient and gentle and forgiving and loving as Jesus has made known to us just this week. I don't know what it would have done if God was some other kind of God, or if I followed some other kind of God. But at any point in my life, I would have been cut off and left to my own destruction, just like all the rest of you. But for the fact that our God is patient and he is gentle and he is forgiving and he loves us more than we can even compute. So thank you, Jesus, for making these things known to us about God. But I've got to say, we could have known all these things about God from the scriptures, couldn't we? We could have known all that about God from reading the Old Testament before this incarnation, that God is patient and loving and gentle and forgiving. It's there, all through the scriptures. But in the person of Jesus and what he modeled and what he did for us, in that incarnated God become flesh, we're shown so much more than we ever could have imagined how patient and how gentle and how forgiving and loving this God is. And all the rest of it, of course. If you haven't met this God yet, by the way, if your head goes round and round in circles this time of year trying to make sense of Christmas, trying to figure out how all these stories and all these carols fit together and what it all does, if you're not quite there yet, then let me give you the heart of Christmas, plain and simple. You are a sinner, just like I am. And you cannot stand before God in your state of sin any more than I can't. There is nothing that you or I could do to fix that. There is just nothing we could do to fix that. That is the state of play. And yet God in the beginning created us to be in a relationship with him, to be in his presence and to be in relationship with him. And so he's made a way for us to be in his presence. We can't deal with our sins, so he did. That's what this incarnation is all about. He funnels all of the judgment, the right judgment to fix all things and rebuke all sin, he funnels it onto himself at that cross. That's why he took on this flesh and dwelt among us. That's the love of God for us in Jesus Christ. Our penalty has been paid now. And with our penalty paid, there is no more debt, and we are cleared. We can be with God. We can be in his presence, and we will be in his presence forever. We will know God, and we will see him face to face, and we'll enjoy him forever. That's what the gospel is all about. So if this is not you just yet, if you haven't quite gotten to this point, then can I urge you this Christmas, this very Christmas day, to just run to Jesus. He has made God known to us, and this God is loving and gentle, and he stands ready to forgive so that you can be brought into his presence and enjoy him forever. And all you got to do is just throw everything else away and run to Jesus. For those of us who already have received this great news already, what is there to say? Just to remind you of this God this morning, who's so gentle, so patient and loving and forgiving, and to just try to help us focus on the outcome of all this. The outcome of all this is peace and joy. Jesus heads to that cross. He says, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you." He says, "I've told you all these things that I've spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete." Jesus said and did everything he didn't say so that we can know this God. We can know for sure that our God is like this, and we can trust in him and have peace and joy like we never could have imagined. And yet it's ours. So may the peace of Jesus Christ be with you this Christmas, and may your hearts be filled with joy as you chew on this and reflect and contemplate on all these things about God that Jesus has made known to us and all the rest of it. And let's sing.